Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Corey Stamper is a rock star lexicographer and editor at Merriam-Webster with a Facebook fan club. Her Ask the Editor videos have thousands of views. Here she's talking about the plural of octopus.
So let's say you're swimming in the ocean and you see some eight-legged cephalopods. You say to your friend, "Hey, I saw a group of octopuses." And your friend says, "Hey, you're an ignorant slob. You saw a group of octopi." So is it octopuses or octopi?
Well, it turns out it's both, as Corey reminds us in her 2017 book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, an occasionally profane behind-the-scenes look at writing one. It's out in paperback this week. We spoke when the book first came out, and I asked her to explain how one class helped pique her interest in words.
It was a class on the Old Norse Icelandic family sagas, which, you know, is about as nerdy as you can get. And our professor was explaining how to say this word, and he said there's an odd sound at the end of this name that is called the voiceless alveolar lateral fricative. And I lit up like a used car lot. I thought, I don't know what that is. Fricative, that sounds obscene. Lateral, that means you can aim it. Voiceless, but you say it. So that's the thing that really hooked me on language itself, not just story, not just words, but language.
Yeah. You went on to study Old English and really just dive down, as you say, this rabbit hole. And in fact, you say, "I was from that point on a woman obsessed. I traced words across the rough sword and buckler of Old English over the sibilant seesaw of Middle English." You go on to say, "I discovered that nice used to mean lewd, stew used to mean whorehouse. I hadn't just fallen down this rabbit hole. I saw it in the distance, ran full tilt at it. The more I learned, the more I fell in love with this wild, vibrant whore of a language." What? Why? Why would you characterize it that way?
Well, English as a language has been stealing words from other languages pretty much since its inception. When we first started speaking the ancestor language of English, which is Old English, we were already stealing words from Latin. We were stealing words from Old Norse. In the, you know, high Middle Ages, we were stealing lots of French words, and we started stealing Italian words. We've just always been a language that kind of sleeps around, and and that's fine, and that's what makes English so beautiful and wonderful and also so frustrating for people who are trying to learn English as either their native language or as a foreign language. I have so much empathy and sympathy for people who are trying to learn English as a foreign language.
Now, you say something in the book that I felt when I started to read it. I thought words were already defined.
Right. Lots of people do. When I tell people what I do for a living, a lot of people say, "Well, we already have the dictionary. Why do you need to write another one?" But old words take on new meanings all the time, and new words come in all the time, and you know, you got to have somebody who's paying attention to that.
So give us some examples, just some things that you had to wrestle with. Take, thinking offhand, well, the definition of that would be, that I'm spacing because I can't, even though I know the word.
Right. And the thing is the definition of take depends on how you're using it, what its context is. So taking the bus is different than taking the witness stand, is different than taking a number, is different than taking a flyer. So all of those takes have to get cataloged. And the way that lexicographers have always done it is to kind of, we look at all of the accumulated written evidence we have for that word, and then we sort them into piles. It used to be paper piles, now it's electronic piles, based on meaning. And once you start doing that, it gets really difficult to pull something apart and say, okay, I'm going to say that take the witness stand is different from taking the bus. So how is that different? Well, do you step up onto it? Is that the sort of core of the meaning? Well, no. When you take the witness stand, you're being entered into an official record. Okay. Is that really it? When you take the bus, do you get on the bus? Do you get in the bus? Do
you have or do you steal it?
Yeah, you steal it. You steal the bus. That's what you do.
Well, you know, being inside your head while you do this, I can see how you describe it as coming upon doors that just go out into air and stairs that go nowhere.
Yeah, it really is. You hit a point with, I think, most particularly long entries where you just feel like, I don't speak English anymore. These words don't make any sense to me. I have no idea what they mean. They're in some weird low German dialect. I don't know what I'm doing. It is a really brain-wrenching exercise.
We have to talk about Irregardless, sadly,
yes.
Because that makes your skin crawl and mine too. But you were tasked with responding to an angry email when it was included in the Dictionary One version. And your first response when you got the email was, that's ridiculous, and explain why you were sure it wouldn't be in the dictionary.
To me, Irregardless is just flat out wrong, because that's what I had been told my entire life.
Take us through it. Ear?
Ear. So that's taken from the word irrespective. And regardless is regardless. So it's a blend of irrespective and regardless. And it means regardless.
Right. People really mean to say regardless of what happened. But why is it in the dictionary?
Because, if you can believe it, this word that everybody has this very specific and vehement dislike of gets used in print a ton. It ends up in edited prose way more than you would think. And it goes back to the late 1700s, I think, is where we've dated it at this point. And I think it actually originated as an emphatic way to say regardless. So yeah. People would say, well, regardless of that and irregardless of the other thing. And that just kind of got flattened when it got into print.
Well, and talk about reader response. I mean, this was one of the cases, and I think you say the spectrum of hatred of irregardless might be unmatched. I mean, you know, what you hear from people when you have to explain why it's in the dictionary, even though you also hate it. And you say that you were prepared for this kind of exchange because once as a bakery assistant, an angry customer picked up an Elmo cake and threw it at your head. And so
yes.
you were prepared for this. But really, can anything prepare you for how people feel about words?
No, it really can't. People feel so deeply about language. Language is very personal for people. And so words like irregardless, people see them as a personal affront.
Yeah. Well, lots of hard work, lots of tedious work noticed by people who love words when it rubs them the wrong way. But then in 2009, there came this. Here's a little excerpt from the Stephen Colbert Show.
Now, I recently learned that Merriam-Webster's has changed the definition of marriage. It now includes the state of being united to a person of the same sex in a relationship like that of a traditional marriage. That means gay marriage. You know, I'm beginning to suspect that Merriam and Webster were conjugating more than just irregular verbs.
This, of course, was the old Stephen Colbert, the fictional conservative character. But this came at a tough time for you. You'd been the focus of a writing campaign. You happened to be the editor who was assigned a response to the inclusion of gay marriage in the marriage listing. What was that like?
It was rough. This was one of these instances where people feel strongly about language because language is a cultural marker. And their concern was that the dictionary is supposed to be an arbiter of language. Language is what expresses our culture. Therefore, the dictionary must be an arbiter of culture. And if you're going to enter this, then, you know, the Supreme Court will refer to it and the world is just going to fall apart and Noah Webster is spinning in his grave. And it was about 3 solid weeks of email. And it was very rough. And because I had to say, we're not describing the thing, marriage. We're describing a use of the word marriage. And that seems like, you know, hair splitting to a lot of people. But that's what lexicography is. We deal with words, not culture, fortunately for everybody around us, because we're all really awkward nerds.
How awkward is it? You know, you love words. You'd rather sit with words than, it sounds like, just about anything. You've interrupted dinners to take cell phone pictures of the menu for citation files.
I have. My kids hate it.
So how awkward is it, and what's the love?
Inside the office, we find it very collegial and very normal, and people who visit find it very weird because it's a whole bunch of people sitting in cubicles, very quiet, not talking to each other. But, you know, everyone who works there and everyone who does lexicography really does it because it's this beautiful puzzle, and you can't do this work and not love English somehow. Otherwise, it would just drive you insane because it's so tedious and so detail-oriented. But we really all sort of have this strong affection for this language that a lot of people feel is really unlovely and unlovable.
Corey Stamper, last March, her book Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, comes out in paperback tomorrow.